This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station. The BFM Breakfast Grill. Top interviews you can't afford to miss. Presented by the CIMB Group.
Blogging has been a popular activity first started in the early 2000s. Fully expressed as weblog, a blog is a journal of self-expression that has today spawned into a plethora of opinion leaders with big followings and advertising potential. Today we speak to Timothy Tia, who is a pioneer in exploiting the space of blog advertising, when together with Singaporean partner Chiu Ming Shen, co-founded Nuffnang, a platform for blog advertising, and the group also later established Chirp Chirp, which provided solutions for social media advertising. Good morning, Timothy. Let's start with the mechanics. How does blog advertising work?
There are many ways you can engage with blogs. You know, we can start with display, that means the banners on these blogs. You can also engage them for in a kind of PR initiatives kind of way. So you invite them for events. You know, you hope that they will, you know, have a good experience with your product and then write about it. You can also, there's also the things called sponsored posts where you can sponsor editorials on their blogs as well. You could also like hold events where you get many bloggers in one place together to create content about your brand on the blogosphere.
Now, you've seen actually tremendous growth, because when you started in 2007 with only 20 bloggers in just Malaysia and Singapore, now you have over 1 million bloggers with operations in the region and, in fact, in the world. You know, if you're talking about Philippines, Australia, China, Hong Kong, Thailand, the UK. Tell us, what has driven this growth?
I guess one thing my partner and I realized when we started out is that if we really wanted to be sizable, we couldn't just depend on the local market here. You know, we had to go abroad, and we invested and we tried very hard going abroad, you know, and we never raised money. So whatever money we made, we kind of poured it back in the first years. Seen some failures. To be honest, we failed overseas sometimes, and we've also seen some successes. So whereas before, Malaysia used to probably account for like, well, we started here in Malaysia, so it used to account for 100% of our revenue. Today, I think it only accounts for like 40% of our revenue. And the foreign markets are still outgrowing Malaysia in terms of annual growth rates.
When you went overseas, did you find any challenges? Because, you know, we're in this internet world of being copycats, right? When someone comes up with an idea, it is very rapidly copied. Yeah. So did you see such competitive challenges when you went overseas?
Yeah. I mean, every different country in Southeast Asia, right, is... The thing about Southeast Asia is it's a very massive population, but the difficult thing about it is it's not a homogeneous population. Every country is different, all the people are different, different languages, different culture, different business practices even. So what we find ourselves doing is really getting onto the ground and making mistakes, learning about how things work in these countries. And not to mention, some of the countries we venture into, there are certain restrictions for foreign-owned companies. Like us. So, for example, we have an office in China that was challenging for us for the first 2 years. And it took about 2 years for us to actually break even, and now it's a very fast-growing, profitable business. So it's challenging, you know.
China is quite interesting because they have this whole community of Weibo, and they also have a very influential and strong blogging community. Yes. But the language that they write in Chinese characters, what is your view of the potential of China?
China's a mega huge market. I mean, and it's a market that is really like no other. There are absolutely very few, or actually no similarities, right, with any other country in Asia, let alone the world. And blogging, in terms of writing articles, there is, it's still something that a lot of people do, and it moves on very quickly. So when we first went in there, Weibo used to be big, and now it's like WeChat taking over. Mm-hmm. And you know, but clients use a combination of everything, and the whole makeup of the blogosphere is very, very different from the way it is here in Malaysia or anywhere in Asia.
Do you go to any country that you fancy? What are your criteria for expansion into foreign countries?
We've always gone to countries whenever we saw opportunities. We started in Malaysia, then Singapore, because my partner is Singaporean, right? And then right after that, we moved into Philippines, you know, and then after that to Australia, because we found opportunities. We see what we get is that we get bloggers from these countries who have heard about us, and then they email us and say, hey, would you start up in our countries? And then we eventually do. So today we're in Malaysia, Singapore, Philippines, Australia, Thailand, China, and we also have a new office this year in London.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what is your revenue right now?
We don't publicly disclose it, but you know, it's over $10 million.
$10 million. That's a pretty sizable. Yeah. What kind of growth are you seeing as far as profitability is concerned?
This year was quite good. It's quite good for us. Last year we had a challenging year. Last year we grew, I don't know, 10% or something. But this year we're seeing growth year on year of like 25-30% in growth. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's looking really, really good this year. Yeah.
And what do you think drives that kind of growth? Is it internet penetration? Is it increasing broadband speeds? Mm-hmm. What are these factors?
Well, I guess like on the macroeconomic scale, right? I mean, online spend is always growing. There's always more and more. It's a growing market, right? So there's always more spend to take. But why we're growing a lot better this year is that there were some things we were not doing very well. You know, I think we were... there are things that we have been better managed internally as well. So we spent the late half of last year kind of like fixing all these problems and all that. I mean, we have a lot of growing pains and all that. And, you know, this year, the results seem to be showing. You know, everyone's really working very well. Ship's moving forward.
Earlier on, you mentioned that Malaysia only comprises 40% of your revenue contribution and the rest is coming from foreign markets. Mm-hmm. Do you see this percentage from Malaysia declining further?
The growth in Malaysia is going to be growing, right? And we see growth from Malaysia, but it's just that the growth from other countries are really, really outpacing the growth in Malaysia. So I do see ourselves being much more of a regional company, getting like revenue from a lot more places. In fact, I do see ourselves in the next 1 or 2 years, even Malaysia accounting for less and less, from 40%, 35% to 30%, you know, and maybe it'll settle around 25%.
Okay, tell us a little bit about the kind of deal that you strike with the advertisers and with the bloggers, because you're right in the middle. Mm-hmm. Right, and obviously, we also want to talk about the fact that internet is all about killing off the middleman, right? And that's exactly what you are—the middleman.
Mm-hmm. For us, one thing people don't realize when they always talk about Navnang, because Navnang's our most well-known brand, but actually today, Navnang, the whole company, Navnang probably accounts for maybe 40-50% of our overall revenue.
Mm-hmm. You also have Chirp Chirp.
Yeah, we have Chirp Chirp, and so what Chirp Chirp does is like it's a platform for brands to kind of like get thousands of users. I can get 1,000 users in an hour to share messages on with their friends on the social platforms, email, whatever platform they have. We also have like a design firm that does mobile applications, web applications in Singapore called Rippleworks. We also have a YouTube content specialist called Reality, so they produce YouTube content. So we have a variety of internet businesses that are really focused on the media side of the business, of online media, right? So whenever we approach clients, they come to us and we have kind of like a whole full scale
spectrum
of things
yeah.
that we can offer them. And so that provides quite a lot of value for things that they can do with us.
So how is that advertising dollars split between yourselves and the blogger?
It really depends because we have very varied products, very varied deals, and we don't publicly really say what it is because we're bound by confidentiality with some of the bloggers. Okay.
And if you're a fairly successful blogger, what can you expect in terms of income?
Oh, in Malaysia?
Yeah.
A fairly successful blogger will earn, I don't know, 100-150k, anywhere around there.
A year?
A year, yeah.
I'm speaking with Timothy Tia, co-founder of Navnang and Chirp Chirp. We'll be back with the topic of competition and the relevance of blog. Today we speak to Timothy Tia, who is a pioneer in exploiting the space of blog advertising, when together with Singaporean partner Chiu Ming Shen, co-founded Navnang, a platform for blog advertising. And the group also later established Chirp Chirp, which provided solutions for social media advertising. So Timothy, tell us about the competitive situation that exists in Malaysia. How much of a market share do you have?
Well, when it comes to the blog advertising space in Malaysia, we have like 95%. But the blog advertising space in proportion to the entire online spend is only a fraction, a very small fraction of it, because online spend is quite sizable and it's continuing to grow.
Of course, that is referring to how internet media advertising is going to nudge out more traditional forms of advertising. But the internet space is definitely a growing space. So you have a 95% control in your space, and that is an almost monopolistic situation. How do you intend to exploit this?
I can't deny we're a monopoly in the blogging space. And part of it is because I think that some things we've done right in the past. But we weren't always a monopoly. When we first started out, we had many, many competitors. And the thing about a market for the blog advertising space is that it's a natural monopoly because there's only space for one player to do it efficiently in the long run.
And that is actually reflected also by the fact that, you know, if you look at companies like Google, sometimes it's a winner-takes-all situation where Google is very dominant in that space of search advertising and browsers and so on. And then in China, we see people like Tencent and Alibaba also dominating in their respective spaces. What I want to know is, does this actually influence a kind of pricing power that you have, and do you intend to exploit this?
It has given us some power to set prices in a way, but we've always tried to find a balance. Like, we've set a price such that it's not too high for advertisers to pay, but it's also high enough for bloggers to want to commit time and write good quality content. And I think we've found that right balance. And a lot of these prices, to some extent, sometimes it's not really set by us, it's actually set by the bloggers as well. Like, even if you say, we can give them a guide, like, hey, this should cost like $1,000. And they go like, no, I think I want $1,500. And then we can adjust the price based on that. So in a way, there's some price setting power there, but there's also some free market forces there driven by the bloggers themselves.
So comparing what advertisers pay you now to what they pay for traditional advertising, is it still an attractive proposition?
I think the days when people used to say that online advertising is much cheaper than offline, I think those days are gone.
What kind of metric do you use to measure that?
Well, I guess if you're going on a cost per impression kind of basis, then yes, you know, online it is still competitive with offline media, right? But if you look at the kind of things brands invest in online, it's not just impressions. They buy into like content, they buy into engagement, they buy into conversations, and these kind of things can cost a lot given X amount of reach. And given that, yes, offline media don't necessarily have that engagement factor, you know, it's still pretty expensive.
So you've come a long way. You now have clients like Singtel and Nike, Honda, P&G, Nokia. How much would an advertising campaign would cost these advertisers based on your kind of media compared with traditional media?
It depends. If the advertiser is an SME, it could cost anywhere from like as low as 5,000 onwards. You know, from bigger brands, you can go up to 50,000, 200,000 for a campaign.
So what would you say are the attractions of advertising online, especially on platforms like Nufnang and Chirp Chirp, compared to traditional media? If you say that your pricing is getting more expensive, then what are the attractions that you offer them?
What clients really want these days is, what brands really want these days is they want content. They can get reach from TV, radio, print, you know. I mean, you know, they can get reach from these outlets, offline media, sometimes even cheaper and more efficiently than online media, right? But what they want from people like us, I guess, is to get people talking about them, you know, starting conversations about their brands, creating content so that when people Google up their brands, they can find these articles about them. It's a deeper engagement with a smaller audience in comparison with the whole millions that mainstream media covers.
How relevant are blogs? You mentioned that, you know, blogs now comprise less than half of your business and also declining. Do you see this declining even further?
It's increasing as an absolute amount. Yeah. But what's declining is because our other parts of our business in the other countries are kind of like outgrowing where we are in Malaysia. Blogs in the past 7 years have really changed. 7 years ago, it used to be very mainstream. Everybody blogs. The large proportion of blogs are like lifestyle kind of blogs and stuff like that. And blogs used to have even stuff like, you know, the kind of content people would write is, hey, I had a very bad day at work, or, you know, the bus was late and I got caught in the rain and stuff like that. It's an avenue to rant. And that was great because it was mainstream, but it also had its fair share of disadvantages because sometimes brands didn't really want to associate themselves to very negative feeling kind of blogs, right, or content. Then came along Twitter and Facebook. And what Twitter and Facebook did is that that became the mainstream place for people to rant and vent their frustration, express themselves, whether it's sometimes positive or negative, whatever it is.
Having the effect of sanitizing the blogosphere.
Yeah. So what it did is that it brought all these casual bloggers over to Twitter and Facebook. And whoever was left were the more serious bloggers. They were serious about writing good content. It also became competitive, you know, for them to write good quality content in order to survive. The good effect that had on us was that suddenly brands were like, wow, okay, you know, they were a lot more willing to kind of invest in blogs. And also the good thing about Twitter and Facebook is that it created outlets for blogs to get popular. Before, if you were a blog, right, it's very hard to get popular because you need to depend on someone linking you or talking about you, right? But now on Twitter and Facebook, if you write something good and people share it, then you get known.
I just want to get a feel from you as to the extent of technological involvement with this whole thing, because you have like millions and millions of blogs. How do you reduce this to a package for the advertisers? How do you monetize this, and how do advertisers actually select among these millions of blogs?
First of all, we need to kind of pull out demographics of our blogs, which we do because we have polls on our blogs that actually are cookie-based, so we can actually track the demographics of everyone who reads, you know, jump from one blog to another. Then we have a whole like back end where we could filter down to say, okay, these are the kind of people that the clients want to target. And then it narrows down from, let's say, you know, a million blogs to like 100,000 blogs. And then after that, it says, okay, you know, let's dig deeper. And it goes down to 50,000, even as low as 3,000 sometimes. And then once with these 3,000 bloggers, we kind of split because it depends. Sometimes clients want a bit of display, so we can run display banners. Sometimes clients want a group of bloggers, let's say 50 or 100 of them, to write about stuff. Or maybe they want just 5 top bloggers to write about, review their products or stuff like that. It's a very varied, customized approach.
Okay, do you see yourself challenging these traditional ad agencies, because more and more advertising is going online?
Well, we're quite specialized and specific in the area we're in, like very straight in social media. We find ourselves actually working with a lot of them much more than competing with them in any way. In fact, I don't think there are any instances where we have actually competed with them. The lines are quite set in that manner.
Any intentions of going that direction?
Not really. It's a whole different skill set. It's outside social media, right? It's offline. It's not really in our skill sets.
You mentioned earlier that the rent has shifted from the blogs to social media like Facebook and Twitter, but you also do a lot of business as far as the those kind of media is concerned. Chirp Chirp is involved in that side of the business. What percentage does this contribute to overall revenues?
Chirp Chirp, I'll imagine maybe 25%.
Talking about people like Facebook and Google, they are really huge, giant behemoths. How do you position yourself compared to these players?
Now, 7 years ago, when I first started out, there were a lot of local sites. You know, they could be sites of like online magazines. You know, they could be sites of even websites of newspapers and stuff like that. And they did well. They were able to get some kind of spend. What has happened in recent years is that Google and Facebook started coming in here, right? And they brought in with them a huge amount of inventory, a huge amount of users that dwarfs any other local player. So much that today, you ask me where most of our online spend goes to, about 60-70% of them would go to Google and Facebook, just two companies. As a result of that, you've seen a lot of these local players one by one phased out. We're one of the few, lucky few, that have managed to kind of survive and thrive under this kind of environment. And if you ask me why, we made some decisions, I guess. You know, when we're looking at, like, for example, when you look at our display ad network for banner ads, right, we predicted that with all this inventory that these big boys are going to bring into Malaysia, it's going to drive down CPM rates, and we're never going to be able to compete with that. So instead of focusing on the display ad side of a business, let's focus on the part where we create content, we create conversations and stuff like that, which is exactly where we shifted our business to, which is why I think we're still doing well today. I think if we didn't make that shift, we would be in trouble. And I think the other local players who still survive today made certain shifts in this manner to kind of survive and evolve.
See, this also relates to my question about whether there would be, at the margin, skirmishes between these new forms of advertising with the traditional form. Because internet advertising through Facebook and platforms like Google are going to become more and more dominant. And both sides, the online side of the spectrum, as well as the traditional advertising spectrum, would be forced to react. Do you think that you will be caught up in that skirmish?
If you're asking whether we've kind of like been tempted to move into services of a creative agency, well, I think that's challenging. You know, that's us learning TV, learning print and everything. You know, it's a whole new experience that is required, not just for myself.
Except that you may not have to learn TV and print in future, right?
Oh, yeah. No, if you're talking about digital agencies, yeah, specifically on digital agencies, right, then yes.
No, I'm talking about the fact that TV and print may not become so relevant in future.
Oh, I don't think that will be the case. Because, I mean, if you look at even the most mature internet markets, the US and UK, right, they still, I mean, online spend is huge. Yes, it's huge. But, you know, still, maybe they take up, online spend takes up 30-40%. There's still a 60% of mainstream media that works, right? And not to mention, the absolute amount of spend is growing every year. So that 60% is, you know, still quite sizable. You know, it's not as small as the 60% it was 7 years ago. So I think there will definitely still be a demand for mainstream media, no doubt about that. I mean, I consume mainstream media myself. I don't watch TV so much, but I listen to the radio. I listen to BFM every day.
Thank you.
Right, so
what is the future funding structure of Nafnang? You've obviously become a highly successful company. Oh. And in the past few years, you've also not seen a shortage of suitors trying to pour money at your doorsteps.
In our 7-year history, we have had many, many tempting offers to cash out, to even sell out completely. But we've never taken that because I guess we always felt we're still young and we still see a lot of promise in the company we're doing, you know. So we thought if it's any time in our lives we're going to take a risk and try to build a company greater than we ever imagined, then it's now. Because, you know, 10, 15 years from now, I might not have the desire to do something like that anymore, or the capacity or the stamina, right? So we've never really done it. We've never taken any funding. All our investments overseas, you know, investments we've made money, investments we've lost money on, it's all been out of our own retained earnings. You know, it's still privately held between my partner and I.
Tell us something about your experience of being a young techpreneur. Because when such money is offered at your feet, you know, I mean, in 2009, it was reported that a party was interested in investing in Nufnang, which valued the company at almost 7 million Sing dollars. Is that Sing dollars?
How do you know that?
This came up in some of our reports.
Okay.
Is it Sing dollars? Or ringgit?
20 million ringgit. 20 million ringgit. So about 7 million Sing.
7 million Sing dollars or about 20 million ringgit. How do you resist such offers? Most other young people would find it very hard to resist.
It was tempting because in 2009, I was 25 years old. You know, and, you know, there must be a lot of money. You know, I'll take half and my partner will take half. So it was tempting for a 25-year-old. But and I was quite happy about it. And I went back to my father and said, hey, Dad, you know, I'm going to be able to repay you the 75,000 ringgit you gave me to start a business. Right? And I expected my dad to say, okay, great, you know. But surprisingly, my dad said, no, don't do it. You know, you must never take that. And I said, why? I mean, aren't you happy that, you know, I made money, right? And my dad said, the only one thing I'm more worried about you not making money in life, is that you make too much money too young. Because then you get complacent, you get lazy, you get cocky, and you will never really live out to the full potential of what you're meant to be.
Some very wise words, some very wise parental guidance. But you are eventually perhaps going to sell out at possibly the right price in an IPO. Is an IPO on the cards?
Yeah, I guess an IPO is always on the cards. You know, in fact, earlier this year, we were even looking at potentially doing one. But one thing my partner and I were very cautious about is that we didn't want to be one of those companies that listed on the AIM and, you know, be a very lowly traded stock. We wanted to be a company that had very significant revenue and very significant profits that grew. You know, that people really, really wanted to invest in, and there would be significant volume in our stock, right? So we feel that today at our size, if you say $10 million kind of revenue, I don't think we're necessarily at that size. Yes, we can list, but would it be a very meaningful listing? I'm not so sure about that, you know. And I know companies have listed for much less, but we just want to be more than that.
Yeah. What is your funding requirement for the next few years, and how are you going to raise that?
We've explored a lot of options. We've explored, we even talked to a lot of VCs, PE funds, you know, even companies talking to us today even about potentially investing. And, you know, we've thought of even, maybe just taking an investor in, you know, let them acquire a small stake and give us some money to accelerate our growth. Because yes, while we're still very profitable, we're still investing a lot into our companies, an injection of funding would really speed up our growth, no doubt about that. We're looking at all these options, but one thing we've always never been able to kind of like pin down is the kind of right people to be able to work with, you know. And I think it's time for us to learn to work with other people, you know, to share a board with, you know, some other experienced investors or entrepreneurs out there.
Let's look at the future of how people access the internet. You know, we've started with the PCs and then moved to mobile smart devices. And now we're talking about wearables and Google Glass. How would you position your company for that future?
We're quite naturally positioned already in the terms of wearables, because wearables and all that, it affects hardware. And people will just consume, on this hardware, they will still consume content on the platforms that they're accessible on these wearables, right? And we're in the content business. So we help brands create content that can be consumed, whether it's on the web or on mobile or on a watch or even on glasses. So in a way, we're already quite primed for something like that.
Thank you. That was Timothy Tia, co-founder of Nufnang, which is a social media advertising platform. I'm Julian Ng, BFM 89.9. Orgs.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.